Hello, and welcome to Mental Health Insights. My name is Craig Faust, and I am a licensed professional counselor. And on this episode, I will have Pete Sandoval, who's also a licensed professional counselor. This episode is going to go along with our Calming a Racing Mind series, but the way that this episode is different is that Pete and I will be talking about how and why a racing mind starts to develop and what implications that has, and we will start walking through the process of understanding how we can go about helping our mind slow down and experience that calmness and that peaceful nature that we might actually be looking for. So this episode, while it may be part three in the series, it is more of a it includes aspects of the first two episodes, so you may not necessarily have to go back and listen to those, although you're more than welcome to if you want. I know some of us are, we like to do things in a certain order, but this is a full measure exploration of the topic, and I'm really excited that Pete came on today to talk with us a little bit about it, especially since this is an area that he is very familiar with, working with his different clients that have high anxiety and trauma, and being able to really give us that type of insight as to what is going on, not only neurologically, but even, biologically, neurobiologically. So I'm really excited for you guys to listen to this and start putting into some of these practices that can help you whenever you notice that your mind is racing. So I hope that you enjoy. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Mental Health Insights. Today we have Pete Sandoval joining us. Hi, Pete.
Hey, Craig. Good to see you.
Good to see you too. So we're going to be talking about a topic that's been pretty popular in the podcast. And so this will be a continuation of the series, Calming a Racing Mind. So this will be Calming a Racing Mind, part three, so to say. And I have Pete on so that we can take a little bit deeper dive into this. And not only some of the intricacies that go into really building a mind that is racing all the time, or where like thoughts are kind of bombarding you, but also talking more in depth about some of those steps that we would want to take to actually start to slow that process down for us. So one of the first questions that I have for you, Pete, because I kind of shared this in some of the previous episodes that, I've experienced having a racing mind. And I wonder for you as a therapist that helps people with this kind of issue all the time, what's it like for you whenever you start to notice your mind racing? Like, what goes through you, especially knowing what you know about this phenomenon?
Great question. So if I notice that I have a racing mind, because of the approach that I use and the way I think about, my own brain and body, if you will, where I go to is, okay, so if my mind's racing, that means my nervous system is activated, and the racing mind is an attempt in my head or in my thinking process, if you will, to try and understand what the problem is. The mind is looking for a solution to a perceived problem, or from a nervous system perspective, a perceived threat. Right. The racing mind isn't in the rational cognitive prefrontal cortex that we typically associate with rational decision-making and calm analysis kind of thing. It is more, something's up. What do I need to do? How do I need to handle it? What do I need to solve? What's my list of things to do? What are the, and on and on and on, right? So right. It's happening more in the midbrain as opposed to the rational brain, despite the fact we often think of it as thinking, or I'm thinking too much. It is thinking too much, but it's a different kind of thinking.
I love how you said that, because I think whenever I talk to people about this piece, they might even call this part of them the analytical part.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like that's actually a mistake. And hearing you talk about this, so if any of you guys are interested, we have different episodes like Brain Basics and like anxiety-based episodes that kind of talk about how this process works. But the short and sweet is whenever you perceive a threat, then what happens is your nervous system only has that one card to play, and it's going to go into a stress response. And one of the things that your brain's really good at is trying to figure out, like Pete says, how to solve the problem of whatever this threat is. And that's where these cascading thoughts come from. And I think it could be something that's especially challenging, because whenever we go into our stress response, all of a sudden our brain is being dumped with additional resources to be able to think, while at the same time, the shift from resources to various areas of our brains gets reduced, where the shift of resources is very much focused on more primitive areas of our brain, or even like you're talking about, like this midbrain portion, and more of like what we might call like the reptilian brain, like the brainstem, to help us to be able to react. And I love how you said that it's actually more of an emotional part. And it sounds like you said, if you kind of notice that this is a phenomenon that's happening with you, it sounds like you start to kind of like talk yourself through it. Like, okay, like what's going on that's like starting to cause, is that right?
Yeah, to some extent. It's funny because the awareness that my brain is racing is in effect due to understanding what we've talked about so far enough to start bringing that prefrontal cortex back online to observe the phenomenon of the racing brain and go, something's going on here, and to start to try and observe it, which in and of itself is one way that it can encourage the nervous system to start slowing down. Anytime I start to observe or invite my brain to start to observe what's going on and what's happening inside, I am now inviting it into a mindful place and attempting
to use.
There's
a shift that happens with
that.
Yeah,
exactly. I'm attempting to create a shift in the nervous system, mm-hmm. just with the process of trying to observe and understand what's going on. So that act of mindfulness is a great way to begin to slow the nervous system down and then begin to parse out what may be going on. I typically then would shift down into more of a body sensory awareness than perhaps to see what's going on in the body, what am I experiencing. That might be one. The other thing I might do is just start to notice where I am and what's going on. So for people familiar with the 5-4-3-2-1 coping skill, it's a really, really quick and easy way to bring myself back into the here and now.
And of course, that 5-4-3-2-1 is where you'll take different senses to mm-hmm. activate them and be able to, like, let me see and notice five things. And even that, right, where you're picking a different sense, whether or not it's your sight, smell, mm-hmm. Taste, touch, sounds, right? You're putting yourself in a position to observe.
That's right.
And I love that you said that the shift that ends up happening. And I noticed that you said that you actually end up taking that shift to noticing what's going on in your body.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of talked a little bit about this before we started recording, but let's say that I'm someone that's like, hey, you know what? I don't like my body. I'm not very good at telling what's going on. And I think that I'm just going to try to think my way through these thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
Like I'm just going to try to kind of combat them, or I'm going to try to kind of counter them.
Mm-hmm.
What would you say to that person?
Well, first of all, the first thing I would say is you have a very strong mind, and obviously some part of you learned at some point that analyzing and understanding, helps you to, solve the problem, calm yourself, and feel better. And let's start there. Let's figure out how and in what way that particular skill has worked well for you. And let's just use that as a springboard.
A springboard into helping them actually observe.
That's right.
What's going on?
Yes, springboard into observation. Because chances are, if it was working all the time, they probably wouldn't be in my office. Right. But we want to leverage it as a strength because it is a strength. And at some point, it was working, right? Mm-hmm. Because if that's their default, then that means it has been helpful. So let's just start there. And an analytical mind is very good, very strong, and very helpful.
I think too, not only is it helpful, but being able to go to that analytical place, I kind of think of it like this. You're trying to fight thoughts with thoughts. And like sometimes you can do that.
Right.
But other times, if we look at this, like there's a fire that's going and I'm just adding air to the fire,
mm-hmm.
Then we have to shift our tactic a little bit, right? Like, what are we going to do with this great resource that we may have?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there might be some people that are listening to this and they're like, well, wait a second. Okay, I'm not very analytical. I don't think about this as much, but like whenever my mind starts racing, it feels like I can't do anything. Like nothing I say or nothing I would do is right anymore. It just completely derails me. And I might as well just sit on the couch or lay in my bed all day whenever this is happening.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like that's almost a very different shift that ends up happening.
Mm-hmm.
And I think kind of talking about what you were talking about earlier, like with the nervous system, I think that it's real easy for us to get focused on what's happening in our head,
mm-hmm.
with the racing mind. So talk to me a little about, if I was like one of those people and I'm hearing you say this, I'm like, okay, I'm going to try to observe what's going on with me. Observe like not only these thoughts, but I want to observe what's going on with my body. What are some things that, you know, they might notice if they tried to shift into that?
Okay. So what's interesting about the question is there's so many variables that will play into that. But typically, if I think where I go is, does the person have comfort going into the body or not, and noticing what's happening in their body or not? And that's a big question, because if the answer is no, which we touched on a minute before, then I'm going to use sensory awareness more, you know, sight, sound, smell, taste, and use touch last as a means of
trying to engage that
because once a nervous system is engaged enough that we have difficulty, whether it's difficulty thinking or doing, now we have to figure out what is the next best strategy to at least slow things down. Because nervous system's activated, we're trying to figure out what's going on or trying to handle a situation. So again, 5-4-3-2-1 is really helpful to begin to slow it down enough. The example that you also mentioned, or as you were talking, I was thinking about somebody who wants to lie down for a minute. What that tells me is that they're feeling overwhelmed, and chances are their brain and body are starting to want to shut down and go away. And that means that they're further down the polyvagal ladder. So they're more in dorsal vagal shutdown, which means too overwhelmed, can't handle it. I need a break. I need some space. I need to maybe even disconnect for a little bit or get some rest. So when somebody's in that state, then it's a matter of maybe just, again, using 5-4-3-2-1 to just tune into where I'm at, what's going on, what's happening. The nervous system responds to whatever neural input it's encountering at the time. And so, you know, what you were saying earlier about combating thoughts with thoughts, well, oftentimes what will happen is combating thoughts with thoughts means that it's continuing to keep the nervous system churning, looking to solve the problem. And if we don't come up with an answer quickly, which again, that may not be a bad way to start, but if we're not coming up with an answer quickly, then that tells us that that strategy probably is falling apart. So getting back to neural input, the five senses are the fastest way to biohack the nervous system to say, where am I? What's happening? What's going on? To start to invite it into a sense of moving towards calm or back up the polyvagal ladder into hopefully maybe parasympathetic or rest and digest. But if we're shutting down, we're kind of near that. So it might just be, well, let me close my eyes for a minute and just take some deep breaths.
You mentioned that polyvagal ladder. And I wonder if someone's listening to this and that's maybe the first time that they've heard of this, the polyvagal ladder is going to really determine a lot of kind of where someone may land whenever this is happening, right? Like that's how intense these thoughts may be or how they're reacting to this. Mm-hmm. So if you could, just in a couple sentences, give us a snapshot of what that polyvagal ladder might look like for those that actually, you know, whenever all of us get amped up in this process.
Sure. So thinking about the polyvagal ladder, we essentially have, we're used to the idea of parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system, or rest and digest and fight or flight. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of near the top, top of the ladder being parasympathetic, rest and digest. Next level down, or coming down the ladder, is fight or flight. And down below that is freeze. And below that is tonic immobility or shutdown. And freeze is more just kind of feeling stuck and unable to move, feeling some sense of overwhelm, but not too much, but just enough that I'm not sure what to do. And I kind of feel
if you're given the opportunity, you can do something, but you're waiting for like that right input.
Yeah, the right input. Perhaps again, thinking through it just enough to come up with an answer, and then you move back up the ladder. But you feel for the moment kind of stuck. But if we go below that, now we're really going into what's called tonic immobility or dorsal vagal shutdown, which essentially means that when we get too overwhelmed or we're stuck in freeze or fight or flight too long, the body basically goes, that's it. I can't handle it. It's too much. I need to go away. Right. And we get that disconnection between what we're feeling in our body, and our brain just wants to kind of go off somewhere and daydream. Sometimes it is, again, the thoughts, but the racing thoughts may not be quite so racing. They more might feel more daydreamy.
Well, it's like you said, you're disconnected in this place. So it would be really hard for the nervous system to actually have enough fuel for those thoughts to actually be as loud or as big or as oppressive as they were.
Yeah.
It's kind of like the body's last ditch effort.
That's right. It is. That is the body's last ditch effort, the brain and body to kind of go, I can't handle it. I need to go away. I need to essentially disconnect just long enough until maybe things settle down around me, or I feel better.
So if I'm someone that's hearing this, it sounds like maybe something that I should be taking from this is that like, oh, hey, like I have a racing mind. Where do I think I kind of find myself on this polyvagal ladder? If I find myself all the way at the bottom, like where I am shutting down and disconnecting, then I kind of know that like whenever this happens, it can get really intense. And being able to help shift myself to a place where it sounds like kind of anywhere you're at the ladder, you want to be able to shift a place to the observation spot. But the further down you are, maybe the more challenging it would be.
That's correct.
So it sounds like almost, I'm kind of thinking about this, the earlier I can catch on that this is happening, the better that it might be for me. Like I might not go from that top of the ladder straight down to the bottom of the ladder every single time. Does that sound right? If I was thinking about this that way?
Yeah. Once the observer kicks in, or the observing mind or mindful mind kind of kicks in, we're significantly increasing the chance of us not dropping further down. Mm-hmm. We slow the process down, and we essentially can at least potentially invite the process to start moving back up the ladder, so to speak.
Well, I love what you're saying. This is probably like the fourth or fifth time I heard you say like that's slow, right? Mm-hmm. And like whenever I have a racing mind, I so much desire things to slow down. And it sounds like the mechanism that we have to use to help us to slow down is to help give our nervous system something to refocus on, mm-hmm. something to kind of consume it with, rather than whatever problem may be at hand. And if we can fill it up, our nervous system up, with these different observations that are happening right now, whether or not it's, you know, I have my hand on this chair and the wood is cool to my touch, right. Or, oh, like there's a contrast. I got these gray curtains that have these little trees on them. Like, okay, like I see that contrast. And then I see this picture over there, mm-hmm. like trying to completely fill my nervous system with a new set of information. Correct. Is what kind of helps me step back up that ladder.
That's correct. Yeah. the brain is designed to use whatever neural input it is to give the nervous system its cues as to what to do next. And remember that the autonomic nervous system is automatic, so we can't control it. And step number one I tell people is remembering that I can't control this, and that's by design. That's okay. But what I can do is invite it into a different state, which we think of as control, but it's important to recognize that we're inviting it, rather than if it's not happening, well, I'm not doing something right. It's more that just to focus on it will automatically do what it's designed to do, bring us back into regulation or relaxation, if we just bring in the right neural input, as you said, something to focus on. That's why breathing and deep breathing is so helpful, because it's sending signals through the body to the nervous system bottom up, rather than thinking it to relax, 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 relax. It doesn't work.
Well, and one of the things I love about what you said, this is kind of an example that I give teens, and sometimes I give couples. If you're in a tough situation, you're in a big heated argument with somebody, you're not going to tell them, hold on a second while I do some breathing exercises to calm myself down. That isn't going to happen. And even if you do that and they're still standing right there and they're still looking really upset, you're not going to be able to have a lot of success with that, because the current threat is right there, mm-hmm. right? If someone is holding a gun to my face and I'm trying to do breathing exercises, I can't control my nervous system to tell it not to worry that I'm going to get shot. Right?
Correct.
So I love the way that you said, like, this inviting part, right? We're inviting it to change, but it's by design that we can't control it, mm-hmm. because if that was the case, then I could be in a real threatening situation and turn off my body's only mechanism for keeping me safe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's all about survival. And the nervous system fundamentally is designed to keep us alive and to do whatever it needs to do to ensure that we survive whatever threat comes our way. And the different levels of the polyvagal ladder are just basically different states of self-preservation that are going on. Fight or flight gives us the most mobility and the most choice, but we're not necessarily consciously always choosing mm-hmm. the degree to which we're surviving. We're just activated or motivated towards that action, and then we respond. Somebody throws something in my head, I don't want to have to stop and think about what should I do or what kind of thing is going towards my head. I want to just be able to allow my reflex to duck and get out of the way.
Yeah, I don't need my physics brain to be like, okay, if I was going to calculate the rate of rotation of this object,
yes,
right? Like that's not important in that moment.
That's right. It's not.
Or I like to tell people, if a car is coming to hit me, mm-hmm. I don't need to think about the philosophical implications of cars and how it's affected humanity's development. I just need to have the resources to get out of the way so that I don't
right.
get run over.
That's correct.
And
exactly.
Kind of one of the things that I'm hearing is that, like, if I'm someone, which I think is most of us, that have this challenge of we have a racing mind and we're trying to calm it, that one, that's a good sign that things are working like they should.
Mm-hmm.
Like, but two, being able to take us from that state of racing mind to that parasympathetic nervous system, that rest and digest part that you're talking about earlier, is going to largely be based on our ability to give our nervous system something else to focus on so we can invite it to shift into another state.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I think that there is so much, life would be a lot easier if we humans weren't as smart as we were or as we are, because there are so many different things that we could take as a threat. There's so many different things that we can interpret as a threat that cause our nervous system to get riled up. And I think that there are so many times where if we're able to give our nervous system some other input, that you're right, like we'll be able to help ourselves get into that observe piece a lot easier, because it's very rare that we're actually in a situation that's actually life or death.
Correct.
And you know, even like as I'm kind of talking about this and as I'm thinking about this, it sounds like really the first step for anyone that has this racing mind is the earlier you can tell that it's happening, it sounds mm-hmm. like the earlier you can shift, because the earlier you can tell, the higher up on the ladder you might be.
Mm-hmm.
And the lower on the ladder you go, the more challenging it might be to actually shift out of that observing mindset.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah, it takes longer. The further down you are on the ladder, the more challenging it is, and the longer you have to provide that different kind of input, or the longer it might take for the brain to actually recognize that the nervous system says, oh, everything's really okay. And a lot of what determines or keeps people further on down the ladder, or sends them further down the ladder, or may keep them stuck in loops, is, you know, obviously family history, trauma, whatever kinds of things that they've experienced in their life. And that essentially the nervous system believes that that's happening again. And so the input is to say, no, it's not. Something right. different is happening than what you may have perceived or you may have experienced at a different time of life.
Well, and that's the whole change that we're trying to get with the nervous system when we're inviting this in, mm-hmm. is we've talked about this in our trauma series, but I think it's also relevant here that you're talking about our nervous system is built to keep us safe. And we have experiences that we have that are stored in our brain that whenever they notice similarities in a situation will trigger that nervous system to help keep us safe. And the more and more that we can invite new input to our nervous system to take in, the easier it becomes for our nervous system to differentiate between what happened then and what's happening now.
Mm-hmm.
I like to, I don't know why for me, it's kind of easier to think about this with like car accidents, right? If I get into a terrible accident right outside my subdivision, and every time I go by that, my nervous system like starts to amp up a little bit, right? Because I'm like mm-hmm. waiting for it to happen again.
Mm-hmm.
The more and more that I can invite my nervous system into the new experience that like, hey, I am okay. Things are all right now. Look, the road is totally clear.
Yeah.
And the more and more I can give it that new input, then the easier it is for it to actually go back up to that parasympathetic nervous system where I want it. And whenever I can get to that parasympathetic nervous system and I can stay there whenever I go through that, my nervous system has more completely been able to recognize that this is a different set of circumstances that that accident happened.
Yep.
And then, gosh, that's kind of the bread and butter where we want to get, right? Where we might not even have that same type of reaction.
Right. Given enough experience, new experience that the brain and body recognize is not the same as the initial event, if you will, in this case, the car accident. It has enough experience with it to kind of integrate the original car accident as something that happened in the past, as opposed to something that might happen again or is happening again. In that brief second that we tense up for a second, uh-oh, it's about to happen again. And then, no, okay, everything's okay. And I mean, what exposure therapy often does is through enough positive experience, it rewires that old experience and the body no longer has the tensing up. But what initially triggers it, as we were talking about the five senses before, is some form of neural input through the five senses. So that's why we use, and I so often use the five senses as a means to create a change in that activation of the nervous system. It's here and now, it's very present. And the nervous system goes, oh, that's what's going on.
Right. Well, and I'm hearing you talk about this. And I think one of the important things is that someone could be listening to this and they're like, well, that's great, Craig. You talked about that car accident. That's something that you know about happened. What about whenever I seem to have a racing mind that happens out of nowhere and it doesn't seem like anything triggered it, or it doesn't seem like anything relevant triggered that? And I kind of want to go back to something that you said earlier, is that there was, you know, you could have some type of family history of something that had happened. There is more and more research coming out all the time about this, that trauma gets passed down through our genetics. And, you know, so if I had a grandparent that almost drowned and that drowning experience gets imprinted on their nervous system, that's very likely that that got passed down to my parents and then could get passed down to me. And to certain circumstances, I could be just sitting by the pool or something like that, and something could trigger my nervous system. And I could be like, well, I've never had any negative experiences around the pool. And I think that's one of the reasons why this can be so powerful, is recognizing our racing mind. It just doesn't come out of nowhere. There's, you know, there's a specific reason our body and our brain isn't all of a sudden like, hey, like, it seems like a nice day, I want to throw a wrench into this, or this would be funny, right? It doesn't happen like that. So for us, there's always a trigger that ends up happening, and it may not necessarily be a trigger that we're even very familiar with. But at the end of the day, being able to get into that observer part, like you're saying, and being able to notice what's going on, it doesn't mean you have to have full understanding of what happened.
Correct.
Because I think that that's kind of what people think sometimes, like, if I have full understanding of things, that's actually going to provide the relief.
Right.
But I'm hearing you say that the actual relief in this is continuing to provide that new information to your nervous system, so that you can then have that new experience.
That's correct. Yeah, it can. And what so often happens is that predisposition for a racing mind happens at some point, typically when we're growing up. It could be, as you said, something epigenetic that happened that, or that, that was passed down to us when we just, you know, one of those nervous kids, if you will. But usually at some point, growing up, that we discover that when we can come up with a solution that works and solves the problem of the moment, and we start to feel better, it now pre-wires our brain and body to say, oh, when I come up with a solution and then I act on it or speak on it, typically as kids, it's usually act on it in some way, and that works, we do it again. And again, and again, until it becomes part of the behavioral pattern of our personality. And then as adults, from out of nowhere, you know, I wake up in the morning, I'm just kind of making breakfast, and all of a sudden my brain starts going, okay, what have I got to do today? I got all this going on, I got that going on, I got this going on, I got that happening. And we're trying to solve that problem. And that's just one example, but there are lots of different ways that our brain can get pre-wired growing up to have that racing mind, if you will.
Right. I think that's important too, for a couple different reasons. One, your brain can get wired this way. Anything that's wired in your brain can be rewired.
Correct.
And on top of that, the kind of like going back to what you're saying, like that is a strength actually that you have, that your brain is wired that way. Because I think that sometimes people get into this mindset where it's like, because I think like this, or because I've had like these experiences, that, you know, this is going to be like this my whole life. Mm-hmm. Like I basically messed it up whenever I was a kid. And now, you know, now my whole life is going to, you know, go to hell in a handbasket type of thing. And that's actually not the case. This system that's built into us is actually built to be able to adjust right. to these new inputs. Like Correct. The nervous system is built to actually be able to be invited into this new state so that it can create these new pathways, these new connections, these new firings together.
Yeah, neuroplasticity tells us that well into our elder years, we still have the ability to rewire things. So that neuroplasticity never goes away. It may be a little bit more challenged as we get older, but that doesn't mean we still don't have the capability to do it.
All right. So you're saying there's still hope for me and my racing thoughts?
Absolutely.
I think that for me, I heard you talk a lot about mindfulness earlier. Mm-hmm. And we talked about mindfulness on this podcast before. And I think that it's something that's important that we've used in this a lot of sensory type mindfulness practices. And I want to distinguish that between mindful practices of maybe just sitting there and trying to meditate. Mm-hmm. Because I think that someone could easily be like, okay, well, I'm just going to try to sit there and you know, meditate and try not to think about anything. And they could end up having a terrible experience with this mm-hmm. because they're actually not providing new input.
Correct.
And I think that, so what you're actually talking about, this mindfulness, is actually sensory input type mm-hmm. mindfulness. So I have a question for you, Pete.
Sure.
What's your favorite type of sensory input to kind of help you get in the present moment? I know mine, but I'm curious about yours.
Wow. I think my favorite is visual, but it's a toss up between visual and auditory. Auditory used to really be the predominant one for me because as a amateur, semi-professional musician, and being a music lover my whole life, it definitely mm-hmm. had a very, very strong influence. But I've also been very, very visually oriented as well. Most of my life, watch a lot of TV, but I also love being in the outdoors and looking at scenery and all of that. And visual and auditory are both pretty high on the list. It's going to depend, I think, on where I'm at and what's available in that moment.
Like you said, that like what's available.
Uh-huh.
Because we could have a go-to thing that's not available.
That's correct. Right?
I love that whenever people are like, well, you know, like I'll just listen to music on my phone. Okay, like what happens if you can't get your phone out?
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to hum the tune?
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to actually have the resources in that moment to mm-hmm. be able to do that?
Mm-hmm.
I think that that's something that's important, right? And I think that there is a certain amount of planning that we can try to do for this,
mm-hmm.
but I think that some of the important things is being able just to use what's at your disposal
right.
in the moment that the racing mind's happening. Right. Like I think of one of the things that I love to do just to ground myself is, you know, those little like Mandarin oranges or cuties or Halos, I think are a couple of the popular brands.
Yeah.
Something about peeling the peel off those and eating them does something, because I could just like smell like the texture of it, because the texture changes from that smooth outer skin
right
to the actual skin of the fruit that you're going to eat, where like it's a little bit softer and it's a little more like malleable. But the smell that actually gets released
from as that, you're peeling it.
Yeah, but I can't sit there and carry around a mandarin orange with me all the time, just in case. But I want to let you know that, and let people this podcast know that, because if you ever see me out and about and you see me peeling a mandarin orange, maybe that's just me trying to make sure that my, you know, that my thoughts that are racing, try to slow them down a little bit.
Mm-hmm. What I like about your example with the orange, Craig, that's so cool, is that it is really getting a lot of the different sensory input simultaneously, and it's behavioral too. So your brain has done a very complex connection to the experience. You've got both, you know, the sight, the taste, the smell, and the sense of touch of it. And then as you're peeling it, there's a behavioral action of the movement. So movement is also very, believe it or not, movement's a great way to reduce the racing mind, because our brain, our body is activated doing something. So it feels like something is happening, and it's a release of the adrenaline and cortisol that's flooding our system that is contributing to the racing mind. So you've got a behavioral act that's going on, and there's a ritual. And the ritual has got a gradual piece to it. There's so much sensory and behavioral components in there that it really does occupy a lot of brain power and brain energy. And the experience has a pleasant experience. So there's a sensation of the taste, and then the chewing and the swallowing, and all of that is creating a very complex positive neural pathways that overwhelm the system with a positive resource, as we call it.
I think that one of the other things I'm thinking of, like whenever you said movement-based, I think that's something that's really important, because a simple walk is something that is providing new neural input. I know that, like, if I'm walking around my neighborhood, I'm always curious to look at the houses to see if I can spot any differences, whether or not that, my neighbors just mowed their lawn the other day, or like, those are some new flowers that they have out there, or anything like that, as a way of continuing to try to like consume that part of the nervous system. And I think that that's something that's so important, because these exercises or these things that we're talking about can be made into pleasant experiences. I know that we can't always live our, we can't live our life in that parasympathetic nervous system.
Correct.
It's not going to happen. You pull out of your garage in the morning or whatever, or you pull onto, the main drag if you're driving, and you almost get into an accident five different times before you get to work. You're not staying in that parasympathetic nervous system, but your nervous system can be very malleable in switching from that one state to the other, given the appropriate amount of practice, and use things that you enjoy doing.
Yes.
I think that's actually the easiest way to calm a racing mind is by using different things that you enjoy doing, because those pathways have already been reinforced in you.
That's right. Yeah. And it's funny, because throughout this entire conversation, we didn't really delve into that. And, we're opening the door to that, and we don't have to, I know we may be limited on time, but I do want to say that movement, getting back to the nervous system, especially once it goes into fight or flight, we have the adrenaline cortisol flooding our system, which is telling our system to move in some fashion. It wants to move, to activate. That's essentially the definition of activation. So what needs to happen? What is our body wanting to or trying to express itself to do? Do I need to duck? Do I need to run? Do I need to fight, right? What is it that needs to happen? So racing minds trying to go, what's going on? What's happening? What do I need to do? If the body starts moving, the brain can, even then, just by taking a walk, moving around the house, picking up something, doing something that has a positive response to it, it can start to tell the nervous system, oh, something's happening, something's going on. And like you were talking about, as you're walking, you're looking at the neighbor's house, you're looking around at the different foliage in the neighborhood. All of that's now creating new neural input visually. So movement is fantastic. It could be exercise. It could be a simple walk. It could be stretching. It could be, you know, just shifting around a chair, getting up and taking a walk down the hallway and then coming back and giving ourselves mindful new input. So it's not just the act of doing it, going, okay, I'm going to get up and take a walk, but my mind's still racing. No, I'm going to get up and take a walk and look around and see what's around me. So adding the new neural input through the five senses as we're moving is really, really key to inviting that nervous system into a different state. But movement is extremely powerful.
Right. Well, and you think about it, it's almost like a different type of, I don't want to say different type of sense. It's a different type of experience, right? Mm-hmm. We have our senses. This is a new different type of experience.
Yes.
It's kind of like if I have people that it's really hard for them, I'm a really touchy-feely type of person. I'm a very tactile person.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I get other people that, kind of like we're talking about right now, it's really hard for them to work with their nervous system or kind of get their nervous system to move out of that place to invite it. And I think that there are different things that we can do to help it along that can be kind to it. Mm-hmm. And just thinking about like my mandarin orange situation, I've recommended different clients, well, okay, how about you freeze the orange and then you use it? Because now you're creating a new type of sense where it's like, okay, it's going from something that's cold to warm the more mm-hmm. that I hold it. And there's actually a state transfer that's happening over time. So correct. It's something that allows you continual observation
mm-hmm.
over something.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, there's a lot of different things that you could do this with. If you're fortunate enough to be in an area that has a pool or you have your own pool or, a tub or anything like that, where you might go and submerge yourself a little bit in water mm-hmm. and kind of sit there and notice like your body acclimating to it.
Mm-hmm.
I think like for some of us that may have a harder time with sensory stuff, adding the movement component or adding a component to it where there is almost like a more potent sensation, right? Like if I'm taking my shoes off and walking across my carpet to give me something to focus on and that isn't doing it, I might lay on my carpet then mm-hmm. and provide more skin contact for it. Yep. Or anything, right? So that I'm actually engaged in the process of giving more input mm-hmm. to my system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting because a lot of the examples you gave were, you mentioned tactile, and I was like, wow, I could hear it as a thread throughout everything you did, that there was a sense of touch that was connected mm-hmm. to it, whether it's the temperature change or the feel of the carpet or the movement or, you know, the orange, the temperature change there too. Tactile really is about touch, and touch is the very first sense that develops for us. Inside the womb, it is the very first sense that we have of separation or being or some sense of something that is us, so to speak. And the other senses then, not only the other organs develop later on, but even after we're born, the other organs come online more specifically. But touch is the first thing that connects us to our primary caregiver, the touch of their skin, the temperature in the air. You know, all of that is what allows us to start to feel safe. It brings our nervous system back into regulation or that parasympathetic response. So touch is one of the quickest, perhaps, ways to begin to slow it down. If for no other reason, as long as the sense of touch is either pleasant or creates a focus, like a temperature change that's not uncomfortable or unpleasant or activates threat, right? It can be very, very powerful. And when you add movement to it, now you are connecting more sense. That sense of movement is a form of touch input, because as the muscles move and everything, we're sensing the change in the skin, the change in the muscles, the tension, all of that is indirectly connected to our sense of touch.
Well, and kind of like you're saying before, and I talked about this actually a little bit last episode, whenever I was talking about sexual relationships and the emotional and the physical piece, if our body has not been a safe place for us, like you're speaking about earlier, mm-hmm. that may be something that's really hard to focus on, which is awesome because we have other senses that we can focus on.
That's right.
That we can notice. And I think that that's one of the coolest things is, like, for us, the more that we can allow ourselves to explore this area of ourselves, observant part, the mm-hmm. more and more that we can. I'm not saying this in a way that, like, hey, you should go and, like, trigger yourself and practice this or anything like that, but it allows for a certain amount of creativity. I don't want you to sit here and listen to this and say, oh, this is what Craig does. This is what works for him. I think I'll go do that. Maybe that works for you. That's great. But that may also not be the best thing for you. Mm-hmm. So being able to be creative and think about these types of things even before you get into the situation where the racing mind happens is something that's totally awesome. Mm-hmm. And you can be at any age to practice this type of thing.
Yeah.
Right. Like if my son's nervous system is going crazy, which at the time of this recording, he's a little over 2 years old, so it's going crazy all the time. I can introduce a sense for him to focus on, whether mm-hmm. or not that's a stuffed animal, or whether or not that's just holding his hand or giving mm-hmm. him a hug,
right.
or anything like that, introducing something for his nervous system to focus on mm-hmm. So that it can be able to move on, mm-hmm. right, if that's needed.
Yeah. And, so often, when people think, you mentioned earlier, mindfulness and trying to stop thinking or stop, we can't stop our brain from thinking completely. But what we can do, as you said, is put our focus on something, and that gives it some neural input of sorts, and that can slow it down. What's also interesting is the idea of breath, and we haven't touched on that a whole lot. So many people are familiar with breath, but noticing the breath and not trying to control it, but noticing it, or maybe trying deep breaths is another way. Again, it sends signals directly from one part of the nervous system to the other part about what's happening and invites it into that different state. That's the most common way people are used to thinking of mindfulness or meditation, just focusing on noticing our breath and trying to change our breath in a way that invites, longer inhale, longer out breath, longer exhale, so to speak. All of those things are really good as well. But I wanted to also, you had mentioned sensory people. Some people have highly sensitive. Mm-hmm. And I think for them, picking things that are very specifically pleasant sensory experiences is really, really key. And also finding ways to block out unpleasant, if at all possible. Noise canceling, headphones or earbuds, wearing, sunglasses or blue light glasses or some form of, maybe even just closing their eyes for a minute and focusing right. on essential oils can be another strong. So carrying little things around with us, pleasant pictures of people or places that remind us of something really, really great. On my phone, maybe having a folder that says resources or calming pics. Start right. flipping through it. And then what you can do is you're looking at a picture of a really good place or really nice people is start to, in your brain, imagine being there. And what are the sensory experience? If it's a beach, what does the air smell like? What is the sound of the ocean? What does the sand feel like under my feet? And it's amazing how in our imagination, our brain will recreate that experience. All of a sudden, it's as if we're there, and now we've got that new neural input.
You know, I love that you say this because it makes me sound less crazy. But I do an exercise with people whenever I talk to them about using their imagination for different things to help recreate different experiences. And I'll take a trash can, I'll put it in the middle of the room, and I'll say, okay, I want you to close your eyes. And I want you to imagine that there is a fire in that trash can, and just imagine it there. And you know, I'll let them do that for 5 or 10 seconds. I'll be like, can you feel some of that heat, like on your knees or on your hands from that? And sure as anything, they'll be like, yeah, I can kind of notice that. I'll be like, okay. Reach your hand out just a little bit closer to that. Like not enough to get burned, just like where you feel it. And like, they'll sit there and they'll go and turn their hand and go roll around it. And they're like,
that's right.
That is, they go, I can't believe that. Like, that's crazy. Like your brain, it has such awesome capability.
Correct.
Or sometimes like people that have challenges with like breathing exercises, like close your eyes and just imagine, you know, what's a pleasant color for you, right? You know, it's like, I'm looking at your background right now, blue, right? Okay. Like whenever you breathe in, just imagine like this calming blue color is coming into your lungs, right? Just notice it like completely filling it up. And then like whenever you breathe it out, right, there's always more for it to come back in. Like using that power of imagination in a really helpful way for us.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's why if somebody is just starting out thinking about meditation, guided meditation is extremely helpful because you're getting, first of all, an external audio or potentially visual input too, depending on what source you're using, but you're getting an external input that is now guiding you into various forms of internal awareness. And in doing so, you're not having to try and force yourself or get your mind to go in that direction. It's a great way to learn how, or if you're a little more experienced, or as Craig is pointing out, if you want to just invite yourself to try, it's amazing what our imagination can do and really come up with. And it is extremely powerful in changing our state, if you will, our calm state or our activated state. Can move it more in the direction that we want it to go.
Well, Pete, I appreciate you talking to this to us about what causes a racing mind and different things that we need to do in order to, you know, improve our practice at knowing how to deal with this whenever it comes up for us and how to give our system a different input. Appreciate the time that you've taken just kind of breaking this down so that it's easier for us to understand this. So thank you for your time.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me. It's always a great pleasure to talk with you and to be able to help others.
And thank all of you guys for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed this episode, then I would ask that you go ahead and give us a review so that other people that are looking to understand more about their mental health and how their mind works would be able to find us. And also so that people would know that there is hope out there for us on this journey as we're seeking to improve our own mental health. And again, thank you for joining us for this episode, and we wish you well. Thank you for listening to our show. This podcast is designed to provide accurate and reliable information, and those that appear on the show are all licensed professionals in the area of mental health counseling. We are in no way rendering legal or medical advice, only information to help serve you better in making decisions in your life. If you need a professional, you should find one. Music you are listening to is called Lobby Time, and that is by Kevin MacLeod and licensed through Creative Commons.